Welcome to Saltgrass, a show about how local communities can engage with the climate crisis at a grassroots level. My name is Ali Hanley. This is the last episode of the three I'm doing about housing solutions in my local community. I recommend that you go back and listen to the first two episodes if you haven't already. If you're listening from a podcast app, you know what to do. And if you're listening on the radio, you can hear the first two episodes at saltgrasspodcast.com or on your preferred podcasting app. Just in summary, though, in the first episode, we heard about how housing density and housing justice are critical climate responses, and we unpacked all of the various reasons why different people might find housing security elusive, and also some of the societal and systemic problems that we need to work out. In the second episode, we met the two researchers from RMIT University who approached me to collaborate on this topic of housing and who proposed that these three episodes be made. They are Andrea Sharam, a senior lecturer in the School of Property Construction and Project Management, and Jen Lynch, a landscape architect and lecturer in the School of Architecture and Urban Design. In the last episode, we heard about what deliberative development is and some of the variations of scale and scope that can be part of that process, including the various levels of community building that may or may not be part of that equation. I included audio from an event hosted at the end of 2023 that included some presentations about deliberative development, including two projects in Melbourne and a local project proposed by WINC, which is Older Women in Co-Housing. So, in this episode, we'll look at some other ideas proposed in this community to address the housing crisis. We're going to revisit all of the people you heard in the first episode about housing. So, Kaz from the My Home Network, Claire and Rosie from Council, and the three women from MASARG, the organisation advocating for appropriate housing for people with intellectual disability. In the first episode, they all explained the different parts of the housing problem in this region. And now in this episode, they're going to share what solutions are being proposed or considered. Some of the solutions complement the ideas of episode two, so co-housing and deliberative development, and others are more about making do with what we already have and working out how to manage existing housing stock better. Before we get to any of that, though, I want to acknowledge that Saltgrass is produced on Jarrah country, the home of the Dja Wurrung. They have been zero waste ecosystem guardians and custodians of this land for countless generations and continue to lead the way and generously share their wisdom on how to live here better. I give thanks to them and honour Jandak, the country itself, and Jarrah elders past and present. Always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
Salt of the earth people. Grassroots change. Saltgrass.
Listen to all episodes of Saltgrass on your podcast app or at saltgrasspodcast.com. You'll remember that in the first episode of these three about housing, we spoke to three women from MASARG, which is the Mount Alexander Shire Accommodation and Respite Group. They are interested in creating appropriate housing for people with intellectual disability. They've already achieved stage one of their plans, which was to build a respite house. Stage two is called Home of My Own, and that's what we're going to hear about now, which is a plan to build housing for adults with intellectual disability. And these are adults who, until now, have been quite dependent and living with their parents, even into middle age. So what they need are housing options that offer ways that they can be supported to live pretty much independently. So this is Jan Steen, who is the president of the MASARG Committee of Management, and you'll also hear some input from Jan Jenkins and Heather Morrison, who are both parents of adult children with intellectual disability.
We've done lots of research. In 2015, with Bev Vines and myself, we did a project called Home of My Own. Now, we started off by having a information day where we invited carers, service providers, interested people, community members, people from the Shire, as many people as we could get together to identify numbers of people who were thinking about getting their child housed safely. From that day, we actually had 18 people put their hands up to participate. So then we did extensive interviews, to find out what everybody wanted, what their needs were. Everyone except for one person wanted to live in town with a friend or a couple of friends and have service providers come in and provide support for them so that they could be safe. Parents were all on board with this, and that was only a snapshot. There's obviously going to be a lot more people out there. And even just from people getting together and having discussion, some people have actually gone ahead and done things themselves. There were two young chaps who wanted to live together. So they have lived together and they went in the private rental market, and that has worked really well for them. I mean, the rental market isn't everybody's cup of tea because A, there's not suitable stuff in town. B, it's not affordable.
Very few things.
It's just... Mm-hmm. It's very difficult. And, you know, we've done things like we've been around to the real estate agents and we've talked to them and to make them aware how great tenants they are because they have a regular income, they're going to have support, all those things. But it's difficult. Now, there's been, from that 18 people, we did a review a couple of years ago, and there's probably only four or five from that original group who are now looking. It's not all positive, you know. Young people have ended up in nursing home because their parents have passed away. Mm. People have had to relocate out of our region because their elderly parents have died. Yes. We've had care recipients who have actually died before they've been enough to find a home of their own. Now, the NDIS does fund some housing, but it's for people with extreme needs. It's 6% of all people on the NDIS who are eligible for funded bricks and mortar. So the other 94% have to find housing of their own some way or other. And look, we don't want people living in a cluster of just all disabled people. Our model, our original model, was a key ring model, which means like you've got a couple of streets, you might be in a little estate or something, and you might have one person at one end of the street, or a couple in one end of the street, somebody else down the other end of the street, and somebody a couple of streets away. And they might be living next door to somebody who's older, who can't get their rubbish tins out. So, you know, the young fellas living there can take the bin out, and then the people next door can just keep a little eye. But they'd have service providers in there supporting it. It's not meaning that the neighbours have to look after the people. It's about living in a village.
Being in the real world.
In a community. Yeah.
So you can see how the development they are planning sounds like something that could potentially become a deliberative development opportunity. Perhaps inviting people into a deliberative process would help them fund the project and get it across the line. I like this proposal because it not only takes care of people with specific needs, but also provides housing for the general community. You remember that smaller buildings and blocks of land, units, apartments and flats are what is so sorely needed in this region. And Mazag are not the only ones thinking about it. Council is also considering development that will give people more options for downsizing and will also provide some social housing for those who need it. This is Claire Richards, the housing broker for the Mount Alexander Shire, and Rosie Anea, who was the mayor at the time of recording.
This is one of the ones that has just been great so far. Yeah. We're so hopeful that it will just come to fruition and will provide housing into the future for our community. So there was a piece of work done on what land council had and what land could be suitable for social and affordable housing. And some of the sites that were identified were where the TAFE building is on Templeton Street. So kind of across from Community House.
Yeah.
And also the council car park behind the Civic Centre. So those two places across the road from each other.
Yeah.
And so what we're aiming to do is activate air rights above those sites. So we will retain ownership of the bottom floor or our car park and either TAFE or something in that building, and then the housing provider will construct apartments on those sites.
It's interesting, that area. The police station's really modern and Castlemaine is quite old school, like a lot of the buildings are heritage and old and have that aesthetic.
Well, there were some concerns around heritage. There always will be. We have a primarily heritage town, but it doesn't mean you can't do anything. I think people see heritage and they go, oh, it's just too hard. But it does not mean you can't do anything. You just have to consider it in whatever you're doing and make sure you're being respectful.
It's not the centre of town, which is much more where the strip of shops is and where the information building is in the park. And that will retain its sort of small town, old school feeling. But it's so central what you're talking about. And that is so convenient for people.
I mean, that one's been pretty exciting. And I think this came through council last year. And, you know, and we were all very excited to move ahead. Obviously, we know we need to chuck in an amount of money if it comes to fruition as well. So we've got a pre-commitment of $5 million, which is a huge amount of money for us. We, you know, we're a small shire. We have a small budget. We do a lot with what we have. For us to pre-commit that much money is meaningful, I think.
The message with any of this housing is that if it's built on council land, as is the case with Templeton Street, then part of that process is that the housing is long-term, ongoing, affordable housing.
Between Mezarg, Council and Wink, it looks like we'll be getting more small-scale accommodation, which is so necessary to ensure appropriate housing is available in this region. But building more new flats, apartments and units is not the only answer. There are other ideas, some of which may help people find housing a lot sooner than waiting for developments to happen. It's important to keep in mind that utilising existing buildings, retrofitting old houses, and working out ways to keep people in their homes are also really good solutions in the housing shortage. Kaz from the My Home Network explained to me some of the more creative ideas people have been talking about.
We're a small network. We don't have funding. We don't have a lot of resources. So it's about how can we be really clever or strategic about getting housing now? Like, we need housing now. Hopefully we get a whole heap of social housing coming here, but it's going to be 5 or 6 years down the track before you get bricks and mortar on the ground. So we realised that there's like about 1,100 vacant dwellings in the Shire. And when I say vacant, the state government definition is it is vacant as per water usage or whatever, at least 6 months a year.
So it might be people who live half the year in Queensland and half the year down here.
Yeah, or it's a weekender.
Yeah.
Now, and we don't know. We can't get segregated data on what the vacant dwellings are, if they are weekenders or whatever. But saying that, because of 6 months, they are not primary Airbnbs. Yeah. Because somebody lives in a primary Airbnb, and they're probably not secondary Airbnbs because they would get used in a lot more. So we know out of that 1,100, we go from about 175 to 212, 220 Airbnbs in the Shire. So there's a significant number of vacant dwellings. So what we thought was, we've seen from other states and other shires, during the bushfires, during the floods, when councils put out an appeal to release those vacant dwellings, they often got a reasonable response. They released 50, 60, 80, sometimes hundreds of homes. So we thought, if we can have respectful, considered conversations with those owners, find out what the friction points are, if they're not keen, just build up a bit of evidence, understanding of how can we do this better. We basically had conversations through trusted people just saying, hey, if you know someone with a vacant dwelling, love to have a conversation, understand why it's not being rented out. Would they consider it either as an affordable rental or transition housing for the housing team? Because we're in dire need of more and better quality crisis and transition housing. So I suppose, you know, we're seeing it in that arc of all of this integrated and interlinked. It's great if we get more crisis housing, but then we need more transition housing. Then we need more affordable rentals for them to get a bit of stability in their life, as well as wraparound supports.
Mm.
So we've managed to get 5 vacant dwellings released as affordable rentals and 3 or 4 released as transition housing and potentially 2 more. Those conversations going on there. Yeah. Because I think in this Shire, 90% of our tenants cannot afford their rental, which is horrendous.
They are affording it, but it puts them under great stress. Stress.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of them, it's over 60-70% plus of their income, which is mad. Absolutely mad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's lots of reasons why people don't want to move away too.
Mm.
You know, like very
absolutely
important reasons, like their whole community's here.
Their friends, family, their supports, their kids are at school here.
Yeah.
You know, they've got relationships. Yeah.
Mm. And aside from that sort of work of investigating potential existing housing stock that might be opened up, what else is My Home Network doing?
Ensuring that we can support people ageing in place. Part of our thing about using current housing stock to better capacity, so home share is, and we're actually calling it home share community, not a home share program, because we don't see it as a service. It's often working with what's called a householder, who is somebody who wants to remain living independently in an appropriate way in their house, but they need a little bit of practical assistance and maybe a bit of company.
So this is someone older?
Yeah, older, or sometimes it's somebody who identifies with a physical or intellectual disability, or women. There's now, in metro situations, there's women with women home shares. And increasingly refugee and migrant situations. So the refugee and migrant may be the home sharer who comes and lives with somebody. So it's about affordable housing for both the householder who's in their home and the home sharer who comes to give practical assistance and company.
They're effectively a housemate.
Yeah.
Are they also providing some service or?
Well, it's practical assistance. So whatever they feel. So it could be, I don't know, gardening, doing the shopping, making meals. It's not transactional. So it's instead of rent. Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's a very considered process. So there's a whole Home Share Australia New Zealand hands are like this alliance that support these models or communities. So there's a whole operations manual. So there's a very considered process around matching and then the ongoing support of that match.
For both parties.
For both parties, yeah.
Because there is a vulnerability if there are people who are vulnerable inviting other people into their house.
Absolutely.
There's a certain risk that they might be taken advantage of.
Absolutely. So there's lots of good evidence building up and they're beginning to develop a really robust kind of evaluation framework of it. And again, looking at health and wellbeing, not just the number of matches, but actually how the health and wellbeing improves in both home share and household.
For both parties.
Yeah. So we've got funding and we've got a local home share coordinator who started working and is at a point, I think, of beginning to make matches, like has done an incredible amount of work in setting it all up in terms of governance and operational and stuff. So that's very exciting. Because there's lots of interest in that, as you can imagine, for all sorts of reasons.
So you can see that the My Home Network is very active in trying to find solutions for the housing crisis, both short-term and long-term. It's worth noting that they're now establishing a working group to look at deliberative developments, which will be a means by which people interested in joining a potential deliberative development or co-housing group can find each other. Similarly, council really is prioritising housing, and sometimes that looks like planning multi-level developments, as we heard earlier, and sometimes that looks like changing local laws to help make some alternative types of housing more possible.
So this started really with conversations with community members and particularly some advocacy from existing tiny homeowners and people within My Home Network in the Tiny Homes Working Group. And really putting into councillors' minds, why can't it be a bit easier than it is? And so one of my colleagues, Councillor Driscoll, put in a notice of motion to say, let's explore what can be done. Is there more that we can do? And so that was the beginning of it. And our team went away and did some research and came back to us with the most we could do within the confines of the local law. Again, this is a bit of a complicated one, but basically the local law cannot conflict the planning scheme and it cannot duplicate the planning scheme. So it has to be something completely separate from the planning scheme. And it's really hard to keep away from the planning scheme in terms of dwellings and stuff, which tiny homes on wheels are not considered to be. So basically, as soon as something becomes a dwelling, it triggers the planning scheme. As soon as there is a commercial element to a house, it triggers the planning scheme because of use. As soon as there is more than one tiny home on wheels, it triggers the planning scheme again because of use. So there are a lot of things that if we wanted to avoid the planning scheme, we just couldn't do. That's not to say that the planning scheme should be avoided. There is so much you can do in secondary dwellings and tiny homes within the planning scheme, but we now have a local law that says that you can camp or live in a caravan or in a tiny home on wheels on a property where there's an existing dwelling for an amount of time. You cannot do it permanently because then you would trigger the planning scheme, but we have removed a specific time frame and we've removed the need for a permit. So prior you needed a permit, you could only stay for 6 months at a time, maybe extending it to 2 years max, but it was very discretionary, so no security there. So what we're hoping that this will enable people to do is live on a friend or family member's property in a tiny home on wheels or a caravan until they figure out what to do next, or just to take the pressure off while they save, or family circumstances have changed. It just gives people options. And I think we were really clear from the start that we knew this isn't going to fix everything. Not everyone can live in a tiny home on wheels because it's just not suitable for everyone, but it's just another option. we had this proposal before us. We said, all right, let's go out for public consultation. And we got the most feedback we've ever gotten on any piece. We got 1,616 individual comments back.
Wow.
And 91%, I think, were in support. And the rest were mostly still pretty supportive, with some concerns. And the concerns were mainly around safety, noise, nuisance, access, stuff like that. But it's felt really good. There are still a few conditions on it around disposing of wastewater appropriately, making sure there's legal access, and not being a nuisance, which I think is the main one. But people are happy. The community has responded well. We feel like we've done something meaningful.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's been that one's been a bit of a great story. The one thing I get asked the most is how many people have kind of taken it up. But we don't know, because we're not asking for them to apply for a permit anymore. But, I mean, anecdotally, a lot.
Yeah.
And the number of phone calls, I was talking to our head of planning, and they were saying that the amount of inquiries, questions, just conversations they have with people just wanting to know how to do it and what's allowed has doubled, tripled, quadrupled. So more and more people are at least thinking about it, which is exactly what we wanted.
Yeah,
feels like a step in the right direction. And, you know, again, huge support from community, which is always a good feeling.
What I really like about this story about Tiny Homes on Wheels is that I know that it came out of a really strong grassroots movement of people advocating for this specific change. And it was a really strategic and purposeful collection of people working to make that happen and talking to council consistently over time. And then when council put out their community consultation feelers, that's why there was this extremely positive response. So it just goes to show how important it is for people in their local community to really advocate and talk to their council about the changes they'd like to see. Council have also just released a really interesting idea about a potential trust to be established to help ease the housing crisis. I think it's worth talking about briefly, and when I interviewed Rosie and Claire, this information was not public yet, so I'll just read something from the press release. So in a couple of months, Council will be considering and voting on whether to help establish the Mount Alexander Affordable Housing Trust, which is MAAHT. MART. It will be a charitable trust that will provide affordable housing solutions. The trust will achieve this by securing land that will then be used to develop housing on. It will accept donations of land or money from community members. The trust will then oversee the development of the housing, either by contracted builders or charitable housing partners. And once built, the housing will be managed in the long term by local or statewide charitable housing partners. But it can take lots of different shapes. So it could be community housing, which is rental housing for residents who are on very low to moderate incomes. Could be independent living, so secure rental housing for older residents, younger residents, or people living with disability. So assisting people to live independently who might otherwise find themselves dependent. Co-housing, so private living space with shared common facilities. Cooperative housing, a group of residents who want to work together to manage the housing, and community land organisations, which is residents who want to build their own homes on long-term land leases. The trust will serve the local community, and residents eligible for trust housing include, but are not limited to, people who are most at risk. So they've listed people who are living in poverty, people who are experiencing family violence, people who are ageing, residents with disability, residents with health problems, residents struggling to afford to live here via the private market housing. So as you can hear, they're really trying to find ways to help the most disadvantaged and vulnerable, which is so great. The trust is an idea being floated by council, and it will be voted on this June. So if you do live locally and want to know more, please contact Mount Alexander Shire Council. I've put the link to the press release in the episode notes. If you think this sounds like a good idea, then let them know. As we heard before around the tiny homes movement, community feedback really makes a difference. So local councils are quite small in the scheme of things. There's only so much they can do, but one thing they can do is talk to state and federal politicians and try to advocate for changes
on a much bigger scale. And our local council has been very active on that front around housing.
You know, we still talk about housing around the table in the chamber an awful lot because it's not like it's stopped being a problem. Like Claire said, the crisis isn't getting better. So we spend an awful lot of time talking about housing. But it is great to see so many things progressing, I think. Mm. Council can feel slow, even to us on the inside sometimes. And I think it can feel particularly slow for people on the outside who don't understand the particular context within which local government works. But it is nice to see and to feel like we're exploring so many possibilities that do set up for the future, that aren't just a band-aid fix, that are things that could genuinely make a difference in the Shire. So, yeah, I'm practicing good patience. And I mean, Claire and I and the CEO, we all do a lot of advocacy as well. So whenever we meet with a state or federal MP or minister, we do a lot of advocacy, and housing is almost always on the agenda because there's power at those levels to make things easier for us at our level. One thing that we always really like to highlight whenever we get a chance to meet with someone from state or federal government is the need for funding programs to really differentiate well between rural and regional. So often we get lumped in with regional, and so we're competing against places like Bendigo and Ballarat and other regional cities for funding opportunities, and our ability to deliver as much as they are is just, it's not the same. We're working at a very different scale than them often, and so often we don't meet the benchmark for the funding, whereas we know what it would mean for our community to have this. So a lot of the time we spend talking to people and saying, you really need to give us different opportunities than our regional cities because our context is so different, and we're just going to miss out time and time again if you keep funding us this way. So that's a big one that we always try and work into literally every conversation we can.
Rural is not regional.
Is not metro. And we can feel a little bit forgotten sometimes just because we do not have the ability to build to the scale that our regional cities do. But we need it just as much. Yeah, or more even. Something that we've talked about quite a bit is the impact of if one job in a rural setting instead of regional or metro can have this incredible impact. And we think that the same is true of housing. The impact of a single house in a rural area, it matters a lot that we have the housing we need here. Because if we don't have the housing, we don't have the professionals that we need to do the services. We can't get people to stay here. We're constantly losing doctors, and doctors is actually one of the main ones. GPs we're always losing because they can't find a house. So, yeah, the impact on community is huge, and we spend a lot of time trying to help people who might be more metro or regional centric to understand what it's like for us in the rural areas.
So in these three episodes about housing, we have heard from a lot of people who are working really hard to try and figure out how to make housing more affordable and more appropriate for lots of different people. And I thought it might be really good to hear from someone who's actually been in the thick of trying to find some housing. And that's my landmate, Sophie, who lives here in a studio at the back of my property. And she's an old friend of mine. When she was struggling to find housing, I offered her the studio at the back of my place. I thought it would be good to hear from Sophie herself about all the different dynamics that were going into her decision making around housing and what it's felt like for her to be trying to find a home for herself and her children in this housing crisis.
I was living with a partner 3 years ago, and we had a rental together, and that double income. It was during COVID, and the pressures of COVID made that dynamic just too hard, and so we decided to separate and live separately. I just didn't have enough money to afford a rental on my own, so I was living in a caravan on a friend's property with me and my three kids half the time, and that worked really well for a few years, and we totally would have stayed there, but council regulations put a lot of pressure on landowners of people living in caravans, even though we were using the toilet up at the house and we had a grey water system and it was all very safe. There's just regulations around it,
which I think have changed now. They've done the tiny house laws have shifted that a bit, but you probably had to move out before that law change came through.
Yeah, it was like a few months before the law change through. So it was a really, it was a bummer. Yeah. Yeah, but it became too hard for the landowners to navigate the council regulations around that, which, yeah, I imagine that that's changed. I'm not across the rules around that now. Yeah, I had to find somewhere else to live. And I had a complete meltdown about it. It was really stressful. My kids were just starting their year at school. I was still trying to navigate work, which I, you know, work for myself, and so I don't have like holiday leave or sick pay or anything like that. My youngest was still at kinder, so I knew there a few days a week. While also looking for housing was really, really stressful, and there were days where I just couldn't stop crying. In Castlemaine at the time, the rentals had gone up significantly in price, so I was looking at like $400 or $500 a week, which was just way outside of my budget. I could
for a 2 or 3 bedroom house.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And this was just a year ago, so it is quite recent.
Yeah, yeah. Yep, this was a year ago. I worked out that I could hopefully afford about $300, and I looked at 1 2-bedroom unit for $300. That was Anyway, it just wasn't going to be workable for me and my 3 kids. And that's when I started having some conversations with Ali about living in her backyard in the studios. And the studios are really, they're not much bigger than that 2-bedroom unit, but it was closer to town, it was cheaper, it was around the corner from a park, it was close to another friend of ours that have similar age kids that my kids were friends with. And I realised that the bonus of having my landlord being a friend, the kids could walk to school, this was just like ticking a lot of boxes, and that it was affordable for me. Yeah, it was really great. Initially, I was a bit worried about the size and the space because there's not really much backyard.
And I've recently done landscaping, which actually makes it less friendly for kids. I used to just have lots of grass, and now I've had someone put in paths and little rock walls, which is actually not as fun for kids because they can't just play cricket.
It's true.
They have found ways to play cricket anyway.
They have, amazingly. Yeah.
And there's still room for guinea pigs to have grass. Yeah.
Yeah. So I had conversations with my kids about expanding their idea of what's our home space to include the park and include our friend's backyard who has a trampoline and to include where they can get to on their bikes. And it took the kids a couple of months to really feel into that, but now they take themselves off to the playground by themselves, and yeah, they found ways to play cricket in the backyard. And we do go see our friend on the corner a lot. The kids cut through her place to walk to school and grab her daughter on the way through, and yeah, it's working really great.
And was there a time when you were looking at maybe moving to another town?
When I found out that I needed to move, I was asking around a lot for advice and if people knew of Leeds, and a few people suggested that maybe I'd have to move out of town. And I did explore that, looked at other towns that had more affordable rent, and I felt the kids already being bedded in this community and already be at school here, and they were already part of the football club and part of parkour, and they had established connections. And also, you know, the 2 dads in my family are still here and the kids spend half their week here, that if I moved out of town, our community is still here and we would have just been drawn back here over and over, rather than like maybe having a whole new life in a new town that had cheaper rental and being able to establish connections there. I would have been like an outlier in that community and being pulled back into this one, but just with an extra driving time and just feeling isolated from the people that are part of my community. And as a single mum who doesn't have another adult around, it's much harder to do anything at night or in the evenings without my kids. Where I am here, there's been times when I've been able to go out, and Gemma's daughter's babysitting my 5-year-old next week while I go to a concert.
Or just tell the boys, hey, Ali's going to be at home. If you need anything, go talk to her.
That's right. Yeah.
And they just hang out at their place, but they feel safe.
Yeah. That.
And they've got an adult to talk to if they need to.
Yeah, that's right. That I can go to the shops and just leave them home for half an hour, and they've got Ali at the front, they've got Gemma on the corner, they can call me off the iPad, and I can just be home in 5 minutes. It just makes like flexibility and juggling and navigating regular life so much easier.
Do you have any dreams of how you might like to live long term? Like if you ever had a property, or do you feel like renting is something that you're happy enough to do for a while?
Yeah, I think I've fully let go of the idea of ever owning my own house. I think being a single mum, like having flexible work where I'm self-employed, just feels really important. Like if the kids are sick, that I can then shuffle my work and come home. So it just feels like that my life is not conduit with a full-time job that can pay a regular mortgage, that rentals and caravans and this kind of lower end scale is much better for my life, so that I can be there for my kids as they grow up and be available to them. And I asked the kids about like where was the favorite place they ever lived in, and their hands down favorite was the caravan. Like simple living, small space, big outside area to play. and they also love living here. And I ask them sometimes about the smallness of the space, and it doesn't bother them at all. Like, they love how close the park is. They love, like, how close they can be with each other. They, you know, like, having their own room, I think, freaks them out because they are so used to being
if they had one room each.
Yeah, they're so used to being around each other.
And they also, like, set up camping. Like, you have your swag out for them in the backyard. And that's they love right. that too. They'll choose that.
On the hot nights, yeah, they were just out in the swag sleeping. So.
Yeah, so it works.
I think that's the benefit of this situation for me too, is having been in a partnership relationship and have that be really tricky and not work, and then wanting to heal and recover from that. Having my own space has been really great for myself to heal some of those things from being in a relationship, and then having a safe space for my kids where they just know it's just the one adult who's going to be talking to them and navigating things. Living alongside any adult that's come from a totally different background to you and has had totally different childhood experiences and totally different adult experiences, and then you try and live in the same house, you know, you often want different lighting, you've got different sound sensitivities, you know, like you've got different cooking needs, you sleep at different times, you know, there's a lot to navigate and balance. And when you've kind of then bring three kids into the mix that also have all their own needs, you've got a lot of dynamics, and it can just put strain and pressure on any relationship. And in some ways, without sounding like a cynic, I actually think a lot of people, you know, could be living separately with their kids. And it's actually given space for me to have really good relationships with the dads of my kids, because we're not under stress of also trying to, like, live together, navigate finances together, argue over the dishes, work out how to parent together. We can sort of just do our own thing and then enjoy our relationship with each other and take that stress off and have connection when we feel like we've got the energy and space and time for it. There's been times when I've felt I really want to have my own house, and I have really let go of that. And I think what I've picked up in its place is a sense of security in the relationships and friendships that I'm building in this community, that I don't need a big house with lots of bedrooms. You know, like, the cleaning alone would drive me crazy. But, you know,
and you're a professional cleaner.
I am. So, you know, like, it's a professional observation. But yeah, that, like, I could have a small space and feel nourished by my connections and my community and feel like my attachment is much broader now, instead of it being like attached to one house or having my own land, that I'm attached to, like, this whole community and, like, that cafe that I love going to and the library and that walking track that I walk on regularly with a friend. Yeah.
Yeah, great.
Wants a better go to work. That was fun.
Yay! Thanks so much.
Pleasure.
All right, I'll see you later. See ya. Cover tonight sounds great.
Yeah, great. All right, let's do it.
So that was Sophie. As you can hear, she's not even feeling like she will ever have a home of her own, but she's also found a way to feel okay about that. And it brings to mind how Australia has quite different customs and legal frameworks around renting to some other places in the world. And I've read some things about how in Europe there are countries where renting is a much more long-term, stable and secure option for people. People can have long leases, 10 and 20 year leases, and they also have the right to decorate and modify their apartment or home as much as they like. There's stronger rights for the tenants. And it's a really different culture around the expectation of home ownership. In Australia, we all kind of feel like we should have a home or a property that we own, whereas over there, I was reading an article, which I'll put a link in the episode notes, and the article was saying that up to 80% of residents in Berlin are renters, and they're long-term renters. It's a very stable and secure way to live. And we don't have that here. So it is more tenuous, and you are more vulnerable as a renter in Australia than you would be if you lived elsewhere. And that is, again, about advocating for legal and cultural change and looking at how maybe we can shift some of those dynamics over time and create better frameworks to give security to tenants and renters in Australia. I love this idea that Sophie was just talking about, how the power that she has is her social capital rather than her assets and her financial capital. She really lives that. She is so beautifully connected to so many people. When we were considering her moving in, we attempted to have some very honest conversations about how living together might impact our friendship and how we would handle that and what we would do if anything awkward came up. And we've had a couple of touching base kind of conversations just to double check that things are going well. And I'm sure that we'll continue to do that. And I think that's a vital part of our renting agreement and how we're living together, because it is a friendship as well as a living arrangement. And that's where the co-housing community-based models of living rely on goodwill, trust and kind of humanity, not just legal rights and contracts. And you know, me sharing my property, it feels great to me. It's much better than share housing because we get our privacy in our own space. But we do also share a lot too. Looking into the future, I could see how Sophie might be a prime candidate for the council's land trust if that were to get up and running. It would just offer people like Sophie a lot more stability and security. And it's great that it's working out between us now, but as her kids grow older and turn into teenagers, they might feel like they need more room than what I can provide here. And so she'll be looking again for something else, and hopefully something will show up that is just right for them. But there'd be a lot more options for her if things like WINC, deliberative development, co-housing, the council's land trust, the council's apartment block that they're planning to build on Tebwinton Street, if all of these things actually went ahead, there'd be a lot more big houses freed up for families like Sophie's, and less competition for them, so hopefully the rentals would be a bit more affordable. Single older people could move into safer and more manageable, smaller properties. The whole system would just settle down a bit. And even for myself, my house is kind of huge and I have a lot of garden that I struggle to maintain even now. So as I age, I like the idea of being able to downsize into something that is a lot more manageable. I personally am a little bit in love with the idea of WINC. I really hope that it gets its legs and that it works out for them because I think I'd potentially put my name on the list. At the time of release of these episodes, they're still in negotiation with council about planning permits. And they're also talking to builders about what to do once they've got the permits in place. At the moment, I love my shabby house. And I just want to point out the importance of being homed. And look, I know people listening will get this. But when I moved here, it somehow alleviated a long-held tension or anxiety that I'd been really barely aware of having until it was gone. And once I moved into this house that technically the bank owned, it just started to dissipate. I was like, oh, I didn't realize I'd been holding on to this weird tension. And it's from a decade of share housing and having landlords able to kick you out within a month's notice. And every time a new housemate moves in, there are different house rules and different dynamics. And once I had my own place, it was just the bank and me. And they don't care how I keep the place as long as the payments keep coming through. I guess what I'm just trying to emphasize is that there are intangible but quite deeply felt effects of having housing security. And share housing and all the rest of that in my 20s was an excellent time of life, and I'm really glad I did it. But at a certain point, I was ready to have my own place, and I fully believe that everyone should be able to have that and to not feel that tension that I felt so long of not knowing if or when you're going to be moved on. And now that I have this place, I'm able to share it with other people who are experiencing insecure housing. There's a lot to think about amongst all of the ideas that have been talked about in these episodes, and different solutions will work for some people and not others, and something might work at one time of life and not at a different time of life. So it's good to think about all of the diversity of options that are out there and know that there are people who might be thinking along the same lines as well. I hope you've enjoyed these three episodes on housing security, and I just want to reiterate that idea of Bill McGibbons that I quoted right at the start of the first episode, where he talked about how our attitudes around housing really have to shift. We can't expect to all have the quarter acre block and the three bedroom house each. To densify our neighbourhoods is actually a really strong climate action, and we need to stop invading our forests, farmlands and wild spaces so that we can build more houses and suburbs. In the meantime, the solidarity and community building that happens along the way as we densify, hopefully, will also make us stronger as we navigate climate change. If any part of the conversation today caught your attention, there are links and notes about the show on the episode page on the Saltgrass website. Don't forget to get your Saltgrass ethical t-shirts from our merch shop. There are new designs all the time. For those of you listening on the radio, please note that you can listen to all of the episodes, including the two previous episodes on housing, on your podcast app or at saltgrasspodcast.com. You can follow us on some of the socials and you can subscribe to our email list to get reminders and updates about the show. This program is made possible with support from Main FM and the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Find out more at cbf.org.au. These three episodes and the research of Jen and Andrea was also supported by RMIT University's Strategic Impact Fund, which supports interdisciplinary research translation through projects that bring together RMIT researchers, industry, and community. My name's Ali Hanley. Thanks for listening.
Salt of the earth people. Grassroots change. Salt grass.
Listen to all episodes of Saltgrass on your podcast app or at saltgrasspodcast.com.